amazing team of volunteers to welcome you and answer any questions you may have. To donate, you can e-transfer controller at ams.queensu.ca with the subject line AMS Food Bank Donation, or bring non-perishables to our location during the service hours. Also check out the Pay What You Can Peach Market, providing equal access changing hunger, in the new medical building for fresh soup and entrees on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. For any questions, please reach out to foodbank@ams.queensu.ca.
Keep up with what's hot on CFRC Airwaves. Find us today on Instagram and Facebook. Follow us at CFRC Music and keep your finger on the pulse of Kingston's best music mix.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And that Representative Al Green be censured with public reading of this resolution by the Speaker.
He did not obey. After Democratic Congressmember Al Green of Texas disrupted President Trump's joint address to Congress, Green was censured by the House Thursday as many of his fellow Democrats sang the civil rights anthem, "We Shall Overcome." We'll speak with Congressmember Green on this 60th anniversary of the first Selma to Montgomery voting rights march known as Bloody Sunday, when Alabama state troopers beat the protesters. The march was led by someone who inspired Green, the late Congressmember John Lewis. Then, as House Republicans push for $2 trillion in federal spending cuts and more than $4 trillion in tax cuts for the richest Americans, we'll speak to Bishop William Barber.
If an unelected technocrat can delete the financial commitments of a government established for the people and by the people, and we don't say anything, we betray our moral commitments to liberty.
And then we look at Nicaragua, which is withdrawn from the UN Human Rights Council after a damning new report criticizing human rights violations by President Daniel Ortega.
The man who once fought against a family dictatorship has now built one that is even more grotesque.
We'll speak to veteran war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody. Today marks 40 years since the release of his 1985 fact-finding report, Contra Terror, in Nicaragua. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump announced Thursday he's exempting his 25% tariffs for Mexican and Canadian goods that come under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, a trade pact that he signed in his first term to replace NAFTA. The exemption's in place until April 2nd for now and comes after Trump spoke with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum. According to the White House, some half of Mexican imports and 38% of Canadian imports are part of this trade deal. Trump's tariffs first went into effect Tuesday, including an additional 10% tariff on Chinese goods, causing markets to tumble. The State Department Thursday ordered an immediate pause on nearly all U.S. funding for aid projects in South Africa. The pause comes after Trump issued an executive order in February in retaliation for South Africa's land reform law, which he claimed was racial discrimination against white South Africans. The pause reportedly spares funding for PEPFAR, the U.S. global HIV/AIDS program. In more news from the State Department, the agency is preparing to shutter a dozen overseas consulates as well as many more diplomatic missions. The move would include laying off many local workers, crucial for U.S. diplomatic relations in those countries. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from firing the head of the U.S. African Development Foundation after Elon Musk's Doge operation brought in U.S. marshals to gain access to the foundation's headquarters Thursday. The judge's order came after the foundation's president sued Doge and State Department official Pete Morocco over their attempts to dismantle the agency, which was established in 1980 to provide grants and loans to small businesses and entrepreneurs in Africa. Attorneys general from 8 states have filed a lawsuit against the Education Department, accusing the agency of unlawfully slashing more than $600 million in federal grants for teacher training programs that had already been appropriated by Congress. The Trump administration froze the funds in February, claiming they're used to promote what it called divisive ideologies like anti-racism. On Thursday, Senate Democrats, including Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, slammed reports that Trump's preparing to sign an executive order abolishing the Department of Education.
So if the Department of Education closes, it's going to hurt millions of families in this country. It's just going to enable the theft of resources from regular families to pad the pockets of the billionaires. But it is also likely to result in you waking up one day and finding out that your local elementary school that your kids go to is owned by a private equity firm on the other side of the country and is being run for profit.
A federal judge Thursday ruled Trump illegally fired a member of the National Labor Relations Board in January and ordered Gwen Wilcox be reinstated. Judge Beryl Howell wrote, quote, "A president who touts an image of himself as a king or a dictator, perhaps as his vision of effective leadership, fundamentally misapprehends the role under Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution," unquote. In related news, the nonprofit union-focused watchdog Labor Lab is warning against Trump's pick to head the Office of Labor Management Standards. Elizabeth Messenger was previously the CEO of Americans for Fair Treatment, an anti-union advocacy group. The USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has been ordered to temporarily reinstate nearly 6,000 workers recently fired by the Trump administration. The order from the MSPB, Merit Systems Protection Board, requires the USDA to return the fired workers to their jobs for 45 days while it investigates whether they were unlawfully terminated. The ruling came just days after a federal judge blocked the Trump administration from firing MSPB board member Kathy Harris, a Democratic appointee whose term doesn't expire until 2028. Harris successfully argued that an MSPB member can only be removed by the president for, quote, inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. Meanwhile, the head of the Office of Special Counsel, which handles whistleblower complaints, has ended his legal fight against President Trump's attempts to fire him. Hampton Dellinger cited his long odds at prevailing in an appeal to the conservative majority U.S. Supreme Court after a federal appeals court allowed Trump to proceed with his termination. Axios is reporting Secretary of State Marco Rubio is deploying artificial intelligence to help identify and revoke visas for individuals the State Department believes support Hamas or other U.S.-designated terror groups. The process involves scanning tens of thousands of social media accounts in particular to identify students who participate in anti-war and pro-Palestine protests since October 7, 2023. Abed Ayoub, head of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, said, quote, "This should concern all Americans. This is a First Amendment and freedom of speech issue, and the administration will overplay its hand," unquote. Earlier this week, Trump threatened to prosecute and deport foreign students who take part in such protests and cut funding for universities that allow them. Undeterred, hundreds of students at Harvard and Columbia this week led protests against former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who had speaking engagements at the Ivy League schools. The Pentagon's inspector general's halting efforts to identify and root out extremism in the U.S. military, saying the initiative does not align with Trump's policies. The watchdog issued a directive last week abruptly ending ongoing reviews of how military branches are countering extremism, as many rank members have been linked to far-right groups, including the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and the Ku Klux Klan. The Council on American Islamic Relations has issued a travel advisory warning immigrants from majority Muslim nations not to leave the U.S. over the next 30 days, amidst reports Trump is poised to announce a new travel ban. According to reports, the ban could affect citizens of Iran, Libya, North Korea, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, Yemen, and Pakistan. It could also include Tens of thousands of Afghans who have been cleared for resettlement in the U.S. and face life-threatening danger in their home country for assisting U.S. forces during their 20-year occupation of Afghanistan. Trump's first-term Muslim ban was repealed in 2021. Meanwhile, some 240,000 Ukrainians who fled Russia's war and are living in the U.S. under temporary protected status are bracing themselves after Trump said he's considered revoking TPS for them. Groups like the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America say they're making sure their community is prepared.
To return to. We're talking about people whose entire towns have been leveled altogether. Where would we be sending them back? To nothing. We're preparing our community by making sure that leaflets for Know Your Immigrant Rights are translated into proper languages for them. That could be Ukrainian, that also could be Russian language, Crimean, Tatar, and other languages.
In related news, European leaders agreed to increase military spending for Ukraine as they met in Brussels for an emergency summit following Trump's decision to suspend U.S. military support for Kyiv. Some 20 nations have also said they're open to joining a coalition of the willing to support Ukraine. President Trump directed members of his cabinet Thursday to take the lead in firing thousands of federal workers rather than waiting for directives from his billionaire advisor, Elon Musk, head of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE.
We want them to keep the good people, and so we're going to be watching them, and Elon and the group are going to be watching them, and if they can cut, it's better, and if they don't cut, then Elon will do the cutting.
Trump's directive came after the Republican-controlled Senate voted to repeal a rule that would subject digital payment apps to the same consumer protections as credit cards and bank accounts. After the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau finalized the rule in November, Elon Musk called for the agency to be deleted. Musk is seeking to turn his social media site X into a digital payments app. Meanwhile, there's been another disaster involving Elon Musk's private spaceflight company. On Thursday, SpaceX launched its eighth test flight of its giant experimental rocket Starship. Several minutes into the flight, the vehicle's second stage began tumbling out of control and re-entered the atmosphere above the Bahamas, creating an artificial meteor shower that rained debris across the Caribbean. The FAA halted flights into several Florida airports and multiple airliners were rerouted around the debris field. The FAA allowed SpaceX to proceed with Thursday's launch, even though the agency has an open mishap investigation into Starship's previous flight in January, which also ended an explosion that littered debris over the islands of Turks and Caicos. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration has ordered Tesla to pay fines of $49,650 for three serious safety violations after a factory worker was electrocuted to death. Victor Gomez Sr. died from electric shocks he received last August while inspecting electrical panels at the Tesla Gigafactory near Austin, Texas. In a wrongful death lawsuit, Gomez's family alleges Tesla was negligent because the panel should have been switched off. OSHA previously fined Tesla $7,000 for chemical hazard workplace safety violations at the Austin Gigafactory. Elon Musk owns about 13% of shares of Tesla, where he served as CEO since 2008. The U.S. Supreme Court's further eroded the power of the Environmental Protection Agency and state governments to safeguard water quality under the Clean Water Act. In Tuesday's 5-4 ruling, the majority overturned measures limiting the discharge of wastewater into harbors and coastal areas, including limits on the release of raw sewage. This comes less than 2 years after the Supreme Court gutted Clean Water Act protections for about half of all wetlands in the contiguous United States. The Trump administration's halted an international air quality monitoring program that sampled pollution levels at more than 80 U.S. embassies and consulates due to what the State Department called budget constraints. The program's credited with identifying soaring levels of particulate pollution around the U.S. embassy in Beijing in 2013, right before China launched its so-called war against pollution. Sudan's filed a case with the International Court of Justice accusing the United Arab Emirates of breaching the Genocide Convention by arming and funding the rebel Rapid Support Forces. Sudan said in Wednesday's filing the RSF and allied armed groups perpetrated, quote, genocide, murder, theft of property, rape, forcible displacement, trespassing, vandalism of public properties and violation of human rights, targeting the Masalit people. The UAE said it would seek an immediate dismissal of the case. News from Syria, at least 70 people were killed, dozens more wounded. In overnight clashes between Syrian forces and fighters loyal to the deposed leader Bashar al-Assad, dozens of Syrian authorities were targeted in various ambush attacks by Assad loyalists in the Latakia and Tartus provinces, which have long been strongholds for Assad's toppled government. Thousands of protesters across that region took to the streets demanding Syrian forces withdraw from the countryside in what was the first massive demonstration against the new government of Syria since Assad was ousted in December. This comes as Save the Children's reporting more than 600 people, including 180 children in Syria, have been killed or injured over the last 3 months by landmines and explosive remnants of war as millions of families return to their homes after 13 years. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has accused Israel of undertaking, quote, the largest displacement of Palestinians in the West Bank since the 1967 war. Philippe Lazzarini added, quote, the refugee camps of Jenin, Tulkarm, Nur Shams have been nearly emptied, unquote. Israel's displaced some 40,000 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since launching its so-called Operation Iron Wall in late January. The 13-year-old narrator of a BBC-produced documentary on Gaza has responded to BBC's decision to withdraw the acclaimed film Gaza, How to Survive a War Zone from its streaming service after pressure from pro-Israeli groups. This is Abdullah Al-Yazouri speaking to Middle East Eye.
My message to the BBC is that I hoped that this documentary can see light and can be successful, can spread the message of the suffering that children in Gaza witness.
Abdul Al-Yazouri says he and his family have received threats and the BBC has not intervened to help protect them. And 60 years ago today, civil rights leader John Lewis led hundreds of voting rights activists over the Edmund Pettus Bridge, marching from Selma to Montgomery for voting rights. Alabama state troopers beat them mercilessly. It would be a turning point in the civil rights movement. 5 months later, President Lyndon B. Johnson would sign the Voting Rights Act into law. Today, civil rights groups are calling on lawmakers to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act at a time when voting rights are facing unprecedented federal threats. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. He did not obey. We begin today's show with Democratic Congressmember Al Green of Texas, who was censured by the House Thursday for disrupting President Donald Trump's joint address to Congress Tuesday night. The dramatic protest came near the start of Trump's record-long 100-minute speech when Congressmember Green rose and spoke out, shaking his walking cane as Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson called on him to sit down.
Likewise, small business optimism saw its single largest one-month gain ever recorded, a 41-point jump.
Members are directed to uphold and maintain decorum in the House and to cease any further disruptions. That's your warning. Members are engaging in willful and continuing breach of decorum, and the chair is prepared to direct the sergeant-at-arms to restore order to the joint session. Mr. Green, take your seat. Take your seat, sir. Take your seat. Members continue to engage in willful and concerted disruption of proper decorum. The chair now directs the sergeant-at-arms to restore order. Remove this gentleman from the chamber.
Yeah. Congressmember Al Green's interruption of President Trump's address Tuesday night came amidst reports that House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries had urged Democrats not to disrupt the address. 10 Democrats joined Republicans in favor of the resolution to censure Green, which said he had, quote, repeatedly violated the rules of decorum. Meanwhile, about two other dozen Democrats surrounded Green in the chamber and sang the civil rights anthem, "We Shall Overcome," as House Speaker Johnson read the censure resolution and banged his gavel before he ultimately had to call the session into recess.
The House had come to order. The House had come to order. Order. That- By its adoption of House Resolution 189, the House has resolved that Representative Al Green be censured. That Representative Al Green forthwith present himself in the well of the House of Representatives for the pronouncement of censure, and that Representative Al Green be censured with public reading of this resolution by the Speaker. House had come to order. The House had come to order.
That's House Speaker Mike Johnson trying to call the House to order as Congress members surrounded Al Green after his censure on Thursday, a day and a half after Trump's speech, singing "We Shall Overcome." Congressmember Al Green has repeatedly called to impeach Trump in the president's first and second terms. For nearly two decades, he's represented his district in Houston, Texas, which is home to many low-income and Black residents. It's great to have you with us, Congressmember Al Green. Thank you for joining us. Why did you interrupt President Trump's speech?
Thank you for having me, Ms. Goodman. President Trump indicated that he had a mandate, and I wanted to let him know that he didn't have a mandate to end or to gut or to eviscerate or to cut Social Security as well as Medicaid. But my focus was on Medicaid, and I said to him, you don't have a mandate to cut Medicaid. Medicaid is needed by people who are not of means. We now live in a government that is of the plutocrats, by the plutocrats, for the plutocrats. They have Medicaid. They have doctors. We have to stand for people who are not as fortunate as others. I have good health care. I want my constituents to have the same health care I have. Many won't have it, but I'm going to protect what they do have.
Now, President Trump has said he is not going after Social Security, yet they are firing thousands of Social Security Administration workers. On the issue of Medicaid, you are not alone in representing so many people who are on Medicaid. In fact, many MAGA Republican Congress members are in exactly the same situation. Are you seeing behind the scenes that they're deeply concerned about these massive cuts to pay for massive tax cuts for the richest Americans?
I have not seen a scintilla of evidence indicating that there is any consternation with reference to the cuts. The state of Texas, Ms. Goodman, was offered $100 billion to aid people who were sick and without means, to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Texas turned down $100 billion to aid the poor because Texas would eventually have to pay 10%. The government would pay 90%. I assure you, I'm concerned, but many of my colleagues are not. We have to fight to protect those who cannot protect themselves.
Let me ask you, I think it was 10 Democratic Congress members joined with the Republicans in censuring you yesterday. I'm wondering, as someone who has survived segregation yourself, in a few years you'll be 80, you've survived Jim Crow, where decorum was seen as a way to dampen protest. What message do you have for all of those who censured you and said you broke the decorum of the legislature?
Well, there's so much to be said about what you've just called to my attention. Let me start with this. The President of the United States of America, at that joint session, pointed over to Democrats and called them lunatics. That was a breach of decorum. The president uses his incivility to take advantage of our civility. I refuse to allow him to do this. The president has to understand that he has to demonstrate some degree of civility and respect decorum himself, but he does not. Now, with reference to my colleagues, I told them I was going to vote present so as not to pressure anyone to vote in any particular way, because I voted my conscience. I did what conscience called upon me to do, and my convictions demanded that I do when I spoke to the president. I would do it again. I regret that I've been censured. There is talk now of removing me from my committee with the Honorable Maxine Waters, the Financial Services Committee. My guess is this is not over, but I will stand on what I have done. I'm not ashamed of what I have done. And when you mentioned John Lewis at the genesis of this interview, it caused tears to well in my eyes. I knew him. I know his story. He told me that he thought he was going to die on that bridge. And he told me about peaceful protest. And the one thing that stands out in my mind is, when you do it, be prepared to suffer the consequences. Dr. King went to the Birmingham jail because he was prepared to suffer the consequences. I'm prepared to suffer the consequences. I don't say I agree, but I will suffer whatever the consequences are because I represent people who cannot represent themselves.
So just to reiterate what you're talking about, today is the 60th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, yes. March 7th, 1965, when John Lewis, your colleague in Congress, before that civil rights leader, led hundreds of voting rights activists from Selma trying to go to Montgomery. They were walking over the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and they were beaten down by Alabama state troopers, John Lewis having his skull fractured. It would be a turning point in the civil rights movement. 5 months later, President Johnson would sign the Voting Rights Act into law. Congressmember Green, do you think this is a Bloody Sunday moment right now? The low point before a high point?
I hope that we have reached the depths of this, but I'm not sure, given the behavior of this president. This president doesn't seem to understand that there are people who don't live in the same level of life that he lives in. He lives in the suites. There are some people who live in the streets, and we have to concern ourselves with them as well. And with reference to that march, may I just share this piece of information? Frank M. Johnson was a federal judge who issued the order to part the way, to cause those officers to leave the Edmund Pettus Bridge and to allow them to march on. I mention him because his place in history has not been acknowledged. He was a white Southerner who was a George Wallace contemporary, but he had the guts. He had the guts and the courage to take a stand that caused him to have security 24 hours a day. They bombed his mom's home. We have to have that kind of courage now. We've got to take a stand against what this president is doing with his incivility. We are going to have to demonstrate. We're going to have to protest. I don't want us to have to hearken back to the 60s, but we are being treated as though we are in the 60s. We have to do more than simply say that we want legislation. We've got to demonstrate, and we've got to protest, and be prepared to suffer the consequences.
Congressmember Green, in 2017, you became the first congressmember to call for President Trump's impeachment from the floor of the House of Representatives. You're doing this again?
I am, and I am currently nearing the end of the first draft. I believe that he has done things that would merit impeachment. For edification purposes, if we wanted to impeach a president for speaking ill of Congress, as the president did, we can do it. How do I know? Because in 1868, Andrew Johnson was impeached for speaking ill of the House of Representatives. Impeachment is not all that the scholars would have us believe it is. It is what Gerald Ford said when he was in the House. Whatever a given Congress concludes that it is on a given time, at a given time, when you can get 218 members, assuming that you have a full complement of members voting, to vote for it, then that's impeachment. It really is that simple. It's been done to presidents before, and of course we know about Clinton and we know about others, but the point that we have to make is impeachment is a remedy for a runaway president who believes that there are no guardrails, who believes that the Supreme Court has placed him above the law, and who is now very close to a point where he will not honor court orders. When he does that, Ms. Goodman, he at that point will become a dictator. We are this close. When he goes over that line, that second, that scintilla of a second, he will become a dictator and we will be under a dictatorship. I refuse to wait until that happens before I act. So I will act in defense of the Constitution and for the people of this country.
Congressmember Green, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to talk about your friend, the former Houston mayor and recent Congressmember, yes, Sylvester Turner, who died Wednesday at the age of 70 after he had attended President Trump's speech the night before. I want to play Sylvester Turner's last public message addressing the potential cuts to Medicaid.
This is Angela Hernandez, my guest tonight for the State of the Union. Angela is here to advocate on the importance of Medicaid.
I'm Angela. I'm from Houston, District 18. My daughter is Daisy Garcia. She's 2 years old. She has a rare genetic disorder, chromosome 8P, inversion duplication deletion. It causes a lot of developmental and medical challenges. So losing Medicaid would be devastating to us.
So please let people know. Don't mess with Medicaid.
That is Sylvester Turner, newly minted congressmember, longtime Houston mayor's last message before he died on Wednesday. Your final thoughts, Congressman Green?
25 years he served in the State House, 8 years as mayor of the city of Houston. He was a public servant par excellence. He cared about people, and he made a difference in the lives of people. I will miss him. When Bishop Dixon called me and told me that he had transpired, I fell to my knees and I cried, literally. Not an exaggeration, because he had just been with me on the floor of the House, and I couldn't believe that this could happen in this way. So I miss him, but I want his family and his friends to know that he served us well. They have my deepest sympathies, and my prayers are going to be that others of us will take up the mantle, the torch that he has carried all of his life. He was a great public servant.
Congressmember Al Green, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Texas Democrat,
thank
who
was
censured by the House yesterday for disrupting President Trump's first presidential address as the second time president. In 2017, Congressmember Green became the first congressmember to call for President Trump's impeachment from the floor of the House of Representatives. Coming up next, as House Republicans push for $2 trillion in federal spending cuts, more than $4 trillion in tax cuts for the richest Americans, we'll speak to Bishop William Barber. Back in 30 seconds.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. And Lord, we shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my
We shall overcome. Dorothy Cotton, Pete Seeger, and the Freedom Singers. It's what Democratic Congress members sang as they surrounded Congressmember Al Green on the floor of the House after he was censured for disrupting President Trump's speech. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House Republicans narrowly adopted a budget proposal last week to cut as much as $2 trillion in spending over a 10-year period, in part to fund Trump's tax cuts. A new analysis by the Congressional Budget Office shows the proposed budget would require massive cuts to Medicaid spending. Meanwhile, Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, has warned the U.S. government will go bankrupt without his Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, which is working to slash $1 trillion from the deficit. This week, hundreds of faith leaders gathered to mark the Christian holy day of Ash Wednesday, Capitol Hill, and to protest the impact the proposed cuts could have on the poor and the vulnerable. This is Bishop William Barber speaking at the protest Wednesday.
If an unelected technocrat can delete the financial commitments of a government established for the people and by the people, and we don't say anything, we betray our moral commitments to liberty.
Faith leaders also shared findings of a new report Wednesday called The High Moral Stake, Our Budget, Our Future, which details how President Trump and the Republican Party are taking more essential services and money away from working people while cutting taxes for the wealthiest. It was authored by Institute for Policy Studies, the Economic Policy Institute, and Repairers of the Breach. For more, we're joined from North Carolina by Bishop William Barber, president and senior lecturer, Repairers of the Breach, national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, founding director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. He's co-author of the new book, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. Bishop Barber, welcome back to Democracy Now! On the 60th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, when voting rights activists tried to march over the Edmund Pettus Bridge, led by John Lewis, and were beaten down by Alabama state troopers. 5 months later, the Voting Rights Act would be signed by President Johnson. Your thoughts on putting history and this moment together and what you were demanding on Wednesday?
Well, thank you so much, Amy. As I was listening to that song, We Shall Overcome, there's another line that says, we are not afraid. And I want to thank Representative Green for his courage and showing the way of courage. He's a dear friend of mine. He's exactly right. You cannot wait until a dictator is in charge. You must challenge the way toward that dictatorship. And we must remember on this day, 60 years ago, we did see that Bloody Sunday. But for nearly 40 years, Amelia Boeington, who was also beaten that day, a woman that John Lewis held in his hand, his arms, they had been working against voter suppression in that particular city. They also connected the issues of voter suppression, voter denial, to economic injustice. Remember, the voting piece was supposed to be a part of the Civil Rights Act of 64, along with raising the minimum wage to a living wage. And those things were gutted out of the 64 Civil Rights Act, which made the 65 March and the 65 Voting Rights Act necessary. At the end of that march, when they finally did reach Montgomery, Dr. King gave an amazing sermon. And he chose not to just talk about voting rights, but he chose to connect voting rights to economic injustice. And in that sermon, he said that the greatest fear of the greedy oligarchs in this country was for the masses of black people and poor white people to join together and form a voting bloc that could fundamentally shift the economic architecture of the nation. And that every time this possibility becomes possible, the forces of extremism and the forces of division sow that division to keep it from happening. I think we see that here today, what's going on with this Congress. And it's amazing to me, for instance, that they would censure Representative Green, they didn't censure our sister out of Georgia. They didn't censor the man who called Obama a lie on the floor. It's a strange time that the cheering, the applauding, but I think we're in a crisis of civilization, really, not just a crisis of democracy. It's going to call people to have to stand regardless of where they are. So what we're dealing with right now, Amy, before I even talk about the specific policy, is this immoral philosophy that's at work. Number one, they're operating off of the deliberate attempt to use executive orders as a way of intentionally violating the Constitution, thereby creating enough confusion to distract people from what's going on in the Congress. Because what happens in the Congress has the weight of law, and the EO doesn't have the weight of law. Number two, we are seeing the tyranny of technology and the dehumanization of people. Number three, we're seeing the attempt to make people justify their existence, which has its roots in racism, apartheid, and Nazism. Number four, we're seeing the denial of equality on every front. Five, we're seeing the outright violation of freedom of speech due to the process, due process and equal protection under the law for all persons, and an attempt to end birthright citizenship. Number six, we are seeing the outright betrayal of liberty. Number seven, we're seeing the idolatry of the certainty of white supremacy, that some people can decide who's in, who's out, who's right, who's wrong. And number eight, we're seeing the misuse of religious Christian nationalism in an attempt to falsely claim that their immoral actions are moral. This is what is underneath, if you will, what we see going on. It is dangerous. It leads us to dictatorships and worse. And we must be courageous in this moment. I think that what you saw happen with Representative Green is just the tip of the kind of pushback we're going to see as the weather gets warmer and as people see more and more the kind of damage that's being suggested by this current budget and this current Congress.
You know, Bishop Arbor, I put this question to Congressman Green as well, asking about his Republican colleagues and whether they're concerned about Medicaid privately, if he's speaking to them privately. You are co-author of the book White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. This is an absolutely key point, that they are representing so many people, for example, on Medicaid, so many people that if these kind of support services are done away with, and it's way beyond support services, it's their constituents as well who will deeply suffer. Can you talk about that in the report that you all came out with?
Well, you know, that's one of the things we ask in our book. What mythology can cause you to stand against your own self? And these extremists who call themselves Republicans have been quite ingenious, quite shrewd in camouflaging, making people think that, say, Medicaid and Medicare are for lazy people, black people and brown people. But that's going to be the rude awakening. As they see these cuts, right now they're just talking about cuts, but when they start seeing that these cuts are going to reach inside of your home, whether you're Republican or Democrat or independent, whether you're from Alabama or Texas or Georgia or North Carolina, that's when the rubber's going to hit the road. Take, for instance, Medicaid expansion. Many of them, all of the southern states except for two, have blocked Medicaid expansion, but it has now caused so much fervor in, say, Mississippi, that there was a poll that 60% of Republicans now want Medicaid expansion among the people, because they basically were told a lie that this really doesn't impact you. The fact of the matter is, what they're considering right now would cost coverage, would take millions of people, not hundreds and thousands, but millions of people away from Medicaid. We're talking about $880 billion in cuts over 10 years. We're talking about 72 million people enrolled in Medicaid, and another 7 million were enrolled in CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. We're not talking about black people or brown people alone. We're talking about all people. And the fact that these congresspersons are going along with this for their own means, for their own funding or whatever they're doing it for their tax cuts, for their rich friend, is the truth is going to come off. The cover is going to come off. There's no way you can do the kinds of cuts they're talking about, it's mathematically impossible without touching Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And the more and more people start seeing who this is hurting, 36 million people, Amy, could lose their coverage. 36 million people from what the House is doing. This is why we did this study, because what people need now is an analysis, not just an announcement of a protest, but an analysis. And so Repairs of the Breach joined with the Institute for Policy Studies and others to say, let's tell the truth. Let's let people know we're talking about 39% of the enrollees in Medicaid are white, 18% are black, 29% are Latino, 4.7% are Asian, 39%, almost 40% are white, and many, many of them in the South, because one-third of all poor and low-wage white people live in the South. This is going to be a moment of reckoning. Before, they just talked tax cuts. They just said what they were going to do. But now, as they actually began to do it, people, as it's implemented, are going to feel the pain, and that's when you're going to see protests and other things like that before. My fear is that energy and hatred of what has been done is going to go somewhere. And there are those of us that must say, yes, we must protest and use every nonviolent tool at our exposure, but that it doesn't turn into something violent, because people are going to be hurt. They're going to feel like they've been lied to. It's been distorted. People that they trusted, this president that they trusted, actually was and has become their worst enemy as it comes to their daily lives.
Bishop Barber, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Bishop William Barber, president of Repairers of the Breach, National Co-Chair of the Poor People's Campaign. We have 30 seconds, also leading the new Center for Public Theology and Public Policy, Yale Divinity School. As the head of the Poor People's Campaign, the co-chair, are you leading another one, though so significant as it resonates back with Dr. King, leading a Poor People's Campaign directly to Washington? We know that the first march on the 60th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, King was not there. He would try to lead the next one, and ultimately, successfully, the third. Your thoughts 60 years later on the kind of action you want to see happen?
We believe that legal action, protest action, legislation action, bar action, preaching in pulpits, standing, sitting in, praying in, standing in, all are on the table. Hundreds of clergy came together yesterday to do the first step toward a nonviolent civil disobedience in action. And that is to inform your adversary, to inform the persons that you're challenging why what they're doing is wrong, why it is unconstitutional, why it is immoral. I can tell you that those clergy people had a glint in their eye. Their faces set like flint. They are serious about where we are. We abdicate our own call and our own moral capacity if we walk away from this moment, and we're not going to walk away from this moment. We will bring the people and the clergy in diverse form of every race, creed, color, because the times require that we do this. This is an attempt to totally unravel and tear apart not just this democracy, but the hope and the health of this country. And we cannot stand down. The only way a king becomes a king is if you bow. And we cannot bow. Bowing is not in our DNA. We have to stand in this moment. And we will see more and more and more intensification and emboldening and agitation. But it will be done in the deepest depths of our nonviolent love justice traditions.
Bishop William Barber, I want to thank you so much for being with us, speaking to us from North Carolina. Coming up next, veteran war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody on Nicaragua. From the terror of the U.S.-backed Contras 40 years ago to the abuses of the Ortega government today. Back in 30 seconds.
Better think about your future, y'all, and don't forget your past. Because all the things we've lived before cannot be lived again. And all our people's tears cannot be shed again. We'll be right back.
about 2,000 black. Think about 2,000 black. By the time the year 2000 comes, our magic be as one. We must teach our people how to come together once again. As we grow as one.
2,000 Black's Gotta Be Free by Fela Kuti and Roy Ayers. Composer, musician, and producer Ayers passed away this week at the age of 84. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Nicaragua, which has withdrawn from the United Nations Human Rights Council following a report last month that urged the international community to address human rights violations by President Daniel Ortega's government. This is the commission's chair, John Michael Simon.
Serious human rights violations have been and continue to be committed in Nicaragua, requiring urgent global action. Excellencies, since April 2018, President Daniel Ortega and Vice President Rosario Murillo have implemented a repressive strategy to ensure absolute control of the state.
El control absoluto del Estado. El grupo ha concluido que la
para- The group has concluded that the repressive apparatus is controlled by President Ortega and Vice President Murillo, with direct support from high-level officials in all branches of government, as well as party members. The chains of command have been well-designed and are managed in a tentacle-like fashion, with the intention of ensuring direct control of various links at different levels in the execution of centralized strategies.
Today also marks 40 years since the release of the 1985 fact-finding report Contra Terror in Nicaragua, which laid out how U.S. policy attempted to destabilize Nicaragua through a campaign of terror directed at its people by funding the Contras. President Ronald Reagan described the Contras at the time as, quote, the moral equal of our founding fathers, sending millions of dollars in funding to the Contras. The testimony of the victims of Contra attacks in the 1985 fact-finding report made it to the front page of the New York Times and exposed the policy of torture, murder, rape, kidnapping, and violence used by the Contras. We're joined now by the author of that report, veteran war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody, who quit his job at the New York State Attorney General's office at the time, spending months traveling through the war zones of Nicaragua collecting people's stories. Reed Brody was recently appointed to the UN Commission investigating contemporary abuses in Nicaragua, which presented their findings last week at the UN Human Rights Council. Reed, thanks so much for being with us today. Talk about your presentation last week at the UN Human Rights Council, just in the days before Nicaragua left the council.
So 40 years after my report on terror by the Contras, the anti-Sandinista Contras in Nicaragua. I was appointed to a UN commission looking at abuses in contemporary Nicaragua. And unfortunately, what we found is that the government of Daniel Ortega and his wife, Rosario Murillo, have step by step eliminated all checks and balances on their power. Today in Nicaragua, there are no independent voices. There is no independent press. All of the NGOs have had to leave the country. 453 Nicaraguans have had their citizenships taken away. Former Sandinista commanders, the former vice president, human rights activists, former presidential candidates. Nicaragua has become a country of enforced silence and surveillance for those who stay in the country. And while those who dare to speak out face a life of exile and denationalization.
Let's talk about how this happened. I want you to go back in time, especially for young people, to understand how momentous it was for the Sandinistas to take over. And you did this stunning report 40 years ago today.
That's right.
About the violence of the Contras. Talk about what came next, the rise of Daniel Ortega, hailed as finally democracy in Nicaragua.
Right. So 40 years ago, I went to Nicaragua. Like many people of our generation, we were excited by the Sandinista Revolution, which had overthrown decades of U.S.-backed family dictatorship under the Somozas. And I went to Nicaragua with a colleague from the Attorney General's office whose brother was a parish priest in a little village in Nicaragua. And in that village, I came face to face with people who saying, you know, the Contras, this U.S.-backed, that the U.S. had armed and financed remnants of Somoza's National Guard to fight against, to try to undermine the Sandinista Revolution, which had begun literacy programs, health care for the poor, doctors in rural areas. But the U.S. was funding these Contras who were destroying all of that. And in this little village, I came face to face with victims of those attacks who said, you have to go back and do something. You have to tell American people what's going on here. And so I came back to New York. I quit my job at the New York State Attorney General's office, and I returned to Nicaragua and spent 5 months crisscrossing the war zones of Nicaragua and taking hundreds of testimonies, and put those testimonies together in a report. And I came back to Washington just as Ronald Reagan was seeking assistance to the Contras and calling them the moral equals of our founding fathers. And my report detailed with these widespread atrocities, rapes, murders, burning of schools and hospitals. It concentrated enough minds in a divided Congress to deny assistance to the Contras. I was attacked by President Reagan as a Sandinista sympathizer, but my report was used by the Nicaraguan government also in its historic case against the United States that condemned at the International Court of Justice American assistance and American aggression against Nicaragua.
So we only have 3 minutes, and you have exposed so much back then and also today. Particular part of the report that has been so important to so many was what happened in 2018. And talk about the co-presidents today.
So, you know, Daniel, the Sandinistas lost the election in 1990. Daniel Ortega then started purging the Sandinista Party, kept trying for running for president. Finally, in 2007, he became president again and began to dismantle all the checks and balances on society. His wife, Rosario Murillo, became co-president. It should be noted that Rosario's daughter, Zoila America Narvaez, accused Daniel Ortega of having raped her repeatedly for many years. Rosario Murillo took her husband's side against her daughter, and at that point began to rise in power to become vice president. And then just 2 weeks ago, a new constitution was adopted in which she is now you have a male president and a female co-president, male co-president, and all the other powers of the state have become mere organs to be coordinated by the presidency. So the last vestiges of checks and balances have been sacrificed at the altar of this now a family. I mean, Daniel Ortega, the man who fought against a family dynasty, the Somozas, has now created a situation where he and his wife are co-presidents, and they can name their kids as vice presidents.
So we have just 1 minute. What happened in 2018?
So in 2018, there was the protest first against the Social Security reform, and then it became a much wider protest. And the government of Ortega Murillo decided to go at them with everything. And they brought out the police, paramilitaries, and as we have shown in our latest report, the military.
Which they denied
at the time. And our report now, based on insider testimony, shows that the military participated in this repression. And over 350 people were killed. And that was really the beginning of what we see until today, in which progressively all of the voices in the country, unfortunately, have been silenced.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Reid. We will link to your report presented at the, that you presented with the others at the UN Human Rights Council again right before that report was presented. Nicaragua pulled out of the Human Rights Council. Veteran war crimes prosecutor Reid Brody. I'll be moderating a panel at South by Southwest Festival in Austin this Saturday at 4 p.m. discussing the premiere of the HBO short documentary Armed Only with a Camera, The Life and Death of Brent Renaud, a film by Craig Renaud about his brother Brent, who was killed by a Russian sniper while reporting in Ukraine on March 13, 2022. It is executive produced by DCTV's John Alpert. For more information, you can see the South by Southwest website. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkey, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Anjali Kamat, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff. To see all information about activities, go to democracynow.org.
Wolf Island and Kingston Massive, Saturday, April 5th, Canada's Reggae Ambassadors, the Human Rights, invites you to join us as we celebrate the release of our new album, One People, at the Hotel Wolf Island. Tickets are $25 advance at thehotelwolfisland.com, $30 at the door. Show starts at 7:30.